All right, I would like to call to order today's faculty senate meeting on Wednesday, January 24th, 2024, the first of the new year at 3 p.m. Pat, can you please verify that we have a quorum?
We do have a quorum.
Great. Can I have a motion to adopt the agenda for today's meeting? All right, well, we can go first Arado, second Bohannon. All in favor, please say aye. Opposed? Abstentions? All right, we have an agenda. Next up is the approval of the November 29th, 2023 minutes. Can I have a motion to approve the minutes for that meeting? Arado first, a second?
Second.
Thank you. Any discussion, changes or edits? Hearing none. All in favor of approving the November 29th, 2023 minutes, please say aye. Opposed? And abstentions. All right, minutes are approved. Pat, do we have any public comment?
No public comment today.
Great. So that brings us to item six, which are faculty senate presence announcements. I've got just a few. First, I wanted to follow up from the last survey that I had asked everybody to go out and return on related to professional development or mentorship or gathering of information to be learned from faculty senators. Later this afternoon, not too long from now, we will have Stephanie Richter joining us to begin part of the conversation related to AI, which is one of those topics that was identified in the survey for further supports. Later in the semester, I believe the March meeting, Janice Hamlet will be joining us to talk to us about a new mentorship program coming out of her office. And that will launch next year, so she'll kind of preview it and share opportunities to become involved in that. And I'm also engaged in ongoing conversations related to various professional development and orientation opportunities, including things related to the budget. We have CFO Middlemist will be joining us at our next meeting in February, as well in April, to share updates on the budget, updates on some of the orientation or overview documents that he's collaboratively putting together, and to share other information about our progress towards university goals related to the budget. And then finally, I've been working to develop orientation type documents to that include things like what is shared governance here on NAU's campus, how does faculty senate fit into that, what the various processes that flow through faculty senate are, including curriculum, tenure and promotion, to make those more transparent and accessible to folks, and to understand how service on this body, university bodies, as well as department and college bodies all kind of connect in the shared governance of the university. So I will be continuing to work on that to bring to this body to share out across campus as a stable resource for folks. And related to that last point, and this is my last announcement before moving on, is please be aware that the recruitment campaign for university committee service will soon begin. So please look in the NIU announcements. There'll be a blurb in there calling for opportunities to serve on university-wide committees that are not part of Faculty Senate directly. And then this information will also be shared with deans and their administrative assistants on February 1st. So please be aware of that and encourage folks that are in your networks to join and serve in those capacities to help help move our campus forward and engage in the shared governance responsibilities that we all have. So those are my announcements. So then that brings us to item seven, which are provost announcements. So if you'd like to come up and share any. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I have three announcements. The first one comes from Vice Provost for Faculty Affairs, Barbara Gonzalez. She wanted me to let you know that she has formed an anti-bullying working group. This working group is developing anti-bullying policy, that's a mouthful, which includes experts on the subject from the ranks of our faculty. The idea is to develop a policy and procedures to protect the rights of students, faculty, and the university community. And the group will be putting together a draft The plan is to have something finalized by the end of spring that could then be brought to this group by the start of the fall semester for review. If you're interested in being involved in that group, please reach out to Barbara Gonzalez, and she would be happy to get you involved in that group, or if you have questions about the process, she's also happy to answer those questions. My next two announcements come from Vice Provost for Academic Affairs, Alicia Shadiman. The first one is related to general education. The General Education Committee has created a task force to look at a variety of aspects of general education. This task force, which is comprised of faculty, staff, and students, has been starting to gather input about the philosophy and guiding principles for our general education program. And there is a survey that has gone live. There's one for faculty, and it went out in the Academic Affairs newsletter. And if you need the link for that, it will also be posted on the Provost Office website. And there's also a similar survey that has been sent out to students. That'll be live for the next several weeks. In addition to that, they're going to be doing some focus groups later this semester, and the idea is to get all of that feedback to then use it in order to form a plan to develop that philosophy and those guiding principles, which will then inform the development of an assessment plan. So if you're interested in that information, you can look back at the Academic Affairs newsletter that came out, I believe, on the 17th of January, or the Provost Office website. And then also wanted to let you know about CurriculOG. If you're not aware, we are going to be getting an online platform to manage our curriculum processes. Those of you who have served on curricular bodies at the department, college, or university level know that those have been manual paper processes in the past, or email attachments, and it's been kind of tricky in the past. And so CurriculOG will allow us to do that in a much more streamlined fashion. This semester, we're building out the system. So if you're in any of those groups, there will be opportunities for training. There will be opportunities to test the system, to get training, to be able to see how it works, to be able to work through the process and understand what the steps are. The hope is that we will be able then to launch that process and use that tool starting in the fall. More information will be coming out about trainings so that curriculum committees at department, college, and university level will have access to test the system, to see it, and to go through the training. So keep your eyes open for those opportunities. Those are the only announcements that I have for all this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing. That does bring us to item 8, which is an update on the Executive Vice President and Provost search. I'll share the overview, and Matt, please feel free to add on as you see fit. So the Executive Vice President and Provost search is holding the first round of virtual interviews this week, and with the committee preparing to select the finalists by the end of the week. The goal is for finalist interviews to occur prior to spring break. Right now, we have 4 dates that are held for those finalist interviews, which will be on campus. Those are February 11th through the 13th, February 19th through the 21st, the 21st through the 23rd, and then we have February 26th through the 28th as an alternate date or a backup date. And we're preparing to bring 3 candidates, 3 finalists to campus, and then holding that final date in case there's weather or other issues. There's going to be an open forum specifically for faculty and one specifically for staff. Both will be offered in person and virtually for those that are not able to be on campus. There will also be an in-person open session for students and shared leadership. These open forum times will be shared out across campus by email and then also posted on President Freeman's website under searches. And to allow for the most participation, we are asking groups to try to attend their designated sessions based on their role. But if it so happens you can't make the staff one and you're a staff member, you're welcome to the faculty and vice versa. And we would rather have you come than not come and participate. Only the faculty and staff open forums are going to be hybrid. Everything else is going to be done in person. And it's part of that is it's really important to the candidates for this role to see us showing up, to see what campus looks like, to engage, as this will be oftentimes their first time on campus. And so that they can have those meaningful interactions on campus to get a sense of what NIU is and what they're hoping to be a part of. So please do consider joining in person as your schedule allows. And then anybody who participates in any of these forums or settings will have the opportunity to fill out an electronic survey afterwards if you're in person or joining via Zoom. That way you can ensure your feedback is shared with the search committee. Matt, do you have anything to add with that?
No, Ben, I think the only thing I'd say is that we've had a really strong interest in the position. I think we ended up with 76 applications. It's a very strong pool, and 76 applications is roughly double the amount of applications we had when we did this, the provost search. We'll have a good group of candidates.
Great, thank you. Are there any questions about the status of that? Seeing nobody moving towards the microphone. If you do, please don't hesitate to reach out, but we look forward to this process unfolding. So thank you. All right, so that brings us to item B, which is Title IX, Addressing Sexual Harassment at NIU, a presentation by Sarah Gardner, who is our NIU Ethics and Compliance Officer. So thank you, the mic's yours.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, everyone. So my name is Sarah Garner. I'm our university's Title IX coordinator. I'm also our ethics compliance officer. I want to thank you so much for being here today, and I'm going to talk a little bit about how we address sexual harassment on the front end, which is a lot of behind the scenes work that you may not be aware of. I also want to acknowledge that there's a lot of people involved in this process. I am one person as Title IX coordinator. We have confidential advisors on campus. We have advocates, we have training staff, we have decision makers, we have appeal agents, we have people that support our students in a variety of capacity. So I do want to acknowledge that it really takes a village to provide services to our students, faculty, and staff as it relates to sexual harassment and sexual misconduct. So I do want to provide a general overview because policy is not made in a bubble. So what happens? Title IX is, I think, like 37 words, and we don't discriminate on the basis of sex. Because we receive federal financial assistance, we cannot discriminate on the basis of sex. That's really all that Title IX says. However, there's some regulations around Title IX, quite lengthy, specific regulations about how the university addresses these types of things. So really, we're looking at when Title IX language, regulations, how is the university going to develop a policy around this to make sure that we're compliant with the regulations and letter of the law? So we look at all of those things. To note, the regulations are currently up for revision. They were supposed to be released a few months ago, and now they're supposed to release this month, and now they're supposed to release in a few months. So the process may be changing in the near-ish future, but right now we're working with some regulations under the 2020 administration. So what we do is we develop a policy, but we don't just look at the regs in Title IX. We look at, okay, what does our state law say about this? For example, our state law requires the designation of a confidential advisor for survivors of sexual violence. Okay, what does that look like procedurally? What does it look like resource-wise? We look at best practices. For example, it's a best practice not to have hearings in person for a variety of reasons, mainly for trauma. So we conduct hearings on Zoom. Also, what are some university interests in the process? Again, let's take into account what we as a university want to do to provide support for our students, faculty, and staff. One of these examples is that when we want to remove a student from an education program activity, who wants to be involved in that conversation and who should be involved in that conversation? So there's a lot of things at play, forces at play when we develop our policy and procedures around addressing sexual misconduct on campus. So what does it look like when there is some sort of instance of sexual harassment, stalking, sexual assault, dating violence, domestic violence, or stalking? So that initial disclosure is made. Then the report is submitted and rights and options provided. And all of that has some training and education component around that. And so a lot of times, you think that the Title IX process is just this investigation and adversarial process that we would be involved with our investigative staff. But really, it's so much more front-end work, providing support for our victim survivors of sexual violence on the front-end disclosure process that's made. For example, when a disclosure is made, how do we want to provide training education to like our first responders, whether that be our police department, our faculty, our staff, our academic advisors, on how to provide an empathetic response? How can we ensure that our students feel supported, both our accused students as well as our victim survivors of sexual violence? So really that training education around that initial disclosure phase. Training education around the report submission process. How can we make sure we're connecting the individual with the appropriate resources, and how can I fulfill my legal obligation to submit that report? There is a training education piece around that as well. And finally, the rights and options. Simply, what are my rights and options related to what I've experienced, and how can I be well informed about what that process or resources look like? So rights and options. So when an individual indicates some sort of experience of sexual misconduct, they have a variety of rights and options. And we're provided all of this information on the front end when we're aware of an incident. So what does that look like? They're informed of ways to provide a formal report, whether that's through the police, whether that's through my office, through the university proceedings, or whether that is anonymously or confidentially. So we want to make sure that they're aware of, hey, we're here to help you. This is how, here are some resources to formally move along with some sort of reporting procedures. We also provide information on supportive measures. You may have gotten an email from me in the past as timeline coordinator saying, hey everyone, I'm working with students so-and-so and they've experienced something. I'm here to assist them. They've requested supportive measures. They're available on a confidential basis. They're really there to support them as they're going through an experience. How can we help student X provide some assistance in their classes, whether it be excused absences because of attending court, whether it be excused absences because frankly they can't get out of bed that day because of the trauma they've experienced. So really providing support to our students because of the experience that they had. They're very similar to DRC accommodations. In fact, we use a very similar framework where we're making sure we're not going to fundamentally alter the requirements of the course and they're not cost prohibitive. So again, thinking creatively about how we can support our victim survivors of sexual misconduct in light of the experience that they had. We also educate about privacy and confidentiality. We tell them, hey, we're not gonna tell anyone about what happened unless there's a need to know basis. Does your roommate need to know? No. Do your parents need to know? No. Who needs to know? Me as talent coordinator needs to know what happened so I can provide you the right information. I'm not going to share that unless there is usually a legal need to know given my position. So when a disclosure is made, think about it. Who needs to know this? Do other faculty members in other departments need to know this? Probably not. Do individuals in even your own department need to know this? No. Let's work one-on-one with the student to make sure that they're providing those support services. I know that right now you're able to put notes in Navigate related to student information. Do not put stuff related to sexual misconduct in Navigate. We don't want that information in that type of record. We want to be able to provide them as much privacy as we can related to the experience that they had. We also provide them information on campus and community resources, such as here's a list of our confidential advisors. Here's information on advisors, support persons. A lot of students don't even know they can get free legal assistance if they're a victim survivor through one of our local legal clinics. So we provide a lot of information to our victim survivors when that initial report is submitted. So what are your responsibilities as a faculty member, an employee of the university? It is understanding privacy and confidentiality. Again, who needs to know this information and how can I ensure that we're providing the privacy that this situation affords? So thinking about, again, who needs to know this information? And this may sound cliche, but just participate in training. I know that everyone gets that annual train notification. It's like, great, when am I going to find time to do this? It's really serious information because, again, we want to support our students to the best possible way that they can. And I always picture two different situations. Disclosure is made. The same situation happens. Same disclosure is made, even to the same faculty member. One response is, you know what? I'm sorry you experienced that. However, these are requirements of the course, and it is what it is. That's one response. No report is submitted. That's the response. And the student's like, well, I can't get out of bed in the morning because I'm depressed. I'm anxious. I physically can't get out of bed. So now I can't go to class. So I might as well withdraw. Or maybe I'm just going to stop going to class. And so now I'm probably going to fail out of my course. That's one way to respond. That's not the right way. Really, the way is disclosure happens. Thank you for sharing this information. I want you to know that I have to report this to our talent coordinator. This information is private, but I really want you to know about rights and options available to you. Again, the information is private and you're really going to guide, and it's your decision on how to move forward. Let me connect you with that information. Report is submitted, rights and options are provided to that individual. Now they're provided that support help where, oh, I can get supportive measures. I don't have to withdraw from classes. I feel like mentally better because I'm connected with counseling. So again, same disclosure, different responses, and really understanding how this works in the grand scheme of things when these disclosures are made really helps support our students when they've been faced with an incident of sexual misconduct. Again, supportive measures. If you get an email from me related to supportive measures, I really want to work together and get creative on how we can provide that support services to our students to make sure that they can be successful in the university despite what they may have experienced. And that's everything in a really, really tiny nutshell. I'm happy to entertain any questions or concerns or any sort of feedback related to either sexual harassment, our process, or anything of the like. So.
Hi, I'm David Valentiner from Psychology. I imagine the work you do is very difficult and complicated because you have to balance the rights of the accused and you have to also protect people who have been harassed. I wanted to ask, in the Title IX investigations, what is the standard of proof that's used in those?
The standard to prove is preponderance of the evidence, which is more likely than not. They typically describe it as 50% plus a feather. This is a standard of evidence that was provided by the federal regs back in 2020.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, that's the same standard of evidence that we use across disciplinary process at the institution as well.
So one of the frustrations that I've heard is that the information is kept confidential or private, as it were, and that there are some people, particularly people who have filed complaints and the people around them who may not be feeling safe. And there's no access to information or there's no information provided to them, apparently to protect the rights of the accused. But it has can have a somewhat demoralizing and daunting effect on people in the environment who have heard, you know, about some of these issues, but don't even know the outcomes or don't even know about the investigation or any of the advocacy that's taking place. I don't know what to do about that, but I'm just bringing that up. I don't know if you've thought about that or have any suggestions for mitigating that.
Yeah, that's a great question. We have thought a lot about that because when you have a situation, it doesn't just affect those two people in the complaint process. It does have a campus and community effect. We are limited, though, by state law, federal law related to privacy, particularly like personnel information. I can't disclose personnel information for someone who is not that specific faculty member. So it's very challenging to provide that outreach to heal the community in relation to a situation without breaking confidentiality related to confidential personnel matters. I do encourage people to reach out to me if they have concerns related to a situation that they are like a bystander to that has an effect on them, and I can explain the process. I am fairly limited though in the information that I can share related to the specifics of what's going on.
So if somebody is not happy with the outcome of the process or doesn't have information and is, you know, in the dark about what has happened, I wonder if there's any recourse or any check on the system short of going into the legal system. Is there any internal mechanisms for review or reevaluation?
I don't know if Lori, I know I do report to Dr. Elish Piper related to Title IX matters. If there's a concern related to confidentiality, how we respond, it can go to the provost office for review or discussion. You know, you did mention legal routes. The Office for Civil Rights or Department of Education also fields complaints related to how we handle sexual misconduct issues on campus.
And there is an appeal process as well. And so if an individual wants to appeal the outcome of an investigation, there is an official appeal process that they can pursue.
Great questions, thank you.
I have two questions. One, I know a lot of what you presented on was student-focused? Does a very similar process play out faculty to faculty or staff and faculty?
Same exact process. So the timeline regulations apply to anyone on our campus, whether you're an 18-year-old student or a seasoned faculty member. Same process.
Great, thank you. And then the other one is, I know we've had conversations and you've come to the Faculty Rights and Responsibility Committee to talk there about ways that faculty might be able to inform or shape or provide information to those places where we're making decisions on campus to how to implement training or implement or do other aspects of operationalizing here. I don't know if you'd be willing to share a space or two where faculty members might be able to be interested.
Absolutely. I mentioned that there's regs coming out. Thank you for that, actually, because I forgot to add something. The regulations are coming out in a few months, probably an effective implementation of August 2024, so our fall 2024 semester. It will be posted in the library for 30 days, so I do encourage people to look at the policy and provide feedback. I would appreciate robust feedback related to our policy. It is going to be a big lift and rewrite because the regulations are completely changing again. And so we are looking at what are some ways that we can provide support to our victim survivors and balance the rights of the accused and also protect the university community. So I do encourage there to be feedback related to our policy. Dr. Sumner's area also oversees our training education related to sexual violence. And sexual misconduct to include our annual training. So I'm sure that her and her staff would welcome feedback related to content in the training, what may be beneficial for you as faculty members.
Thank you. All right, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, my name is Sahar Vahabzadeh from Mechanical Engineering Department. Thank you so much for your presentation. I have one question that do you provide the same training as what we have for the faculty and staff for the students about the Title IX?
The faculty and staff receive different training than our students. The student training is fairly student-focused with student resources. We also have a grant from our Office of Violence Against Women with the Department of Education that has information that we should include in our student training, so they do look a little bit different.
Okay, and is that mandatory for them?
For students?
Yes.
We highly encourage it for our students.
Okay.
Our grant also, a condition of our grant is also student completion of training. So in order to continue receiving the funding for our grant, we need as many students to take this training as possible.
Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah.
All right, now I think that's the last question. So thank you, Sarah.
Yeah.
Next up, we have Blackboard AI Design Assistant and Stephanie Richter, the Director of Teaching Excellence and Support from CITL, will be joining us.
So, hello everyone. I am Stephanie Richter, and I want to talk a little bit about artificial intelligence support in general and specifically about a tool that is currently being piloted in Blackboard for our faculty to use. So a couple of announcements first. We have just released a new toolkit for faculty on artificial intelligence in higher education, particularly focused on teaching, although there are some resources related to research and other uses you make use of AI. The QR code there or the URL underneath it will take you directly to the toolkit, so feel free to check that out. It's also linked on the front page of our website at niu.edu/CITL, and we'll be including this in our next monthly newsletter as well to highlight the toolkit as a resource for you. It includes information about generative AI mostly. Obviously, AI is not strictly generative AI, although that I think is where most of our attention as a community has been focused. And it will continue to evolve. We welcome feedback as well. This toolkit also specifically includes a resource we made available, I believe, about a year ago, almost a year ago now, related to policy for AI use that you might include in your syllabus. We don't have a prescriptive policy, but we do offer a resource that has numerous examples of policies that have been used in syllabi at NIU and at other institutions. So it's a great resource for you to find example language that fits for your discipline, your course, your teaching style. So I do encourage that you visit the toolkits, find what you can there. If you have other resources you're looking for or other information you're looking for, please do let us know. We're also in partnership with the teaching and learning centers at other MAC institutions in order to continue to evolve that resource and to provide professional development opportunities from any of our institutions. So within the toolkit, there is a page related to workshops and professional development where we have both recorded sessions. We held two panels here at NIU with our NIU faculty and staff as experts, as well as some recorded sessions from other institutions. And we'll continue to keep that page updated as new opportunities become available. And then the final opportunity that I wanted to announce that we are in the final stages of securing is another opportunity through the Association of College and University Educators, AQ. You may be familiar with, we've been offering a year-long course on effective teaching practices and a shorter 8-week micro-credential on inclusive teaching. They have launched a similar style course that is fully self-paced related to artificial intelligence. It is, as with all of their products, an expensive offering, so we're flexing how we offer other AQ products in order to make room in our existing budget for this, basically. And there'll be limited number of faculty who we have seats available for. But we'll have announcements about that hopefully in the next few weeks so that there's still time to complete that course. It's about 4 hours, this one. It's a much shorter engagement, but that course covers things like how to generate prompts, how to make use of it effectively, how to facilitate dialogue critically about the use of AI with your students as well. So more to come on the support that CIDL can offer for all of you. And we encourage dialogue and feedback about it as well. If you'd like to consult with one of our staff around how you might incorporate artificial intelligence in your courses, we'd be happy to have some conversations around that as well. But the other reason I'm here is to talk specifically about the Blackboard AI Design Assistant. So this was a feature that Blackboard introduced last summer. And we have been, I would say, slowly over time investigating, researching before we simply enabled it for everyone to use. We wanted to be thoughtful about how we made it available. The AI Design Assistant is built on Anthology, which, by the way, Anthology is the parent company that owns Blackboard. Anthology's trustworthy AI framework, where they have seven key principles around how they incorporate AI into their tools. I want to highlight a few of those, specifically the humans in control. So when I talk a little bit more about the capabilities of the AI Design Assistant, it isn't doing anything without your review and approval. So it isn't changing your courses, it isn't changing anything with your students without presenting it to you for your review. They also value the privacy, security, and safety. So in your potential use of the Blackboard AI Design Assistant, none of the data that you provide to the AI assistant is used to train the AI. It is not shared with other institutions. It is not shared even really with Blackboard. It is passed through to the AI in order to give you results and not stored or shared. And the other piece here that I would say that is really strong that I'll talk about a little bit too is fairness in trying to ensure that we don't cause harm to you, to the students, to the institution through incorporating AI. You can find in the slides here at the bottom, which I know will be shared after today, a link to the full Trustworthy AI Framework if you'd like to read it more. And I encourage you to peruse that as you have time. So the Blackboard AI Design Assistant is built on Microsoft's Open AI, which builds on a number of AI technologies that you've probably heard of, like GPT 3.5 or GPT-4, which power ChatGPT, as well as DALL-E 3, which is an engine that generates images. But the Microsoft OpenAI creates a more walled garden that, again, creates a little more privacy and security in how you engage with artificial intelligence. It has been tuned as well, specific to a higher education academic use case, as opposed to a really general broad pool of data. It does incorporate additional information from your course in trying to refine results to give you. You can refine it further using some built-in tools, but as opposed to going to ChatGPT to request something like test questions to be written, this uses the context directly in your course, in order to generate those, and again, doesn't store that information in their own system. It also doesn't require you to be able to engineer a prompt to get what you're looking for. That is all sort of baked into the back end of how the AI Design Assistant works. And then, as I said, everything must be reviewed and accepted by you before it's incorporated in your course, at which point it becomes transparent. It looks no different from any other content that's in your course, because now it is, you have created it now, you have accepted it and brought it into your course. And as I said, nothing that you create, nothing that is in your course ever goes back to train the AI models, which again, if you're using something like ChatGPT, would be going back into and feeding their AI models and their large language model as they work through that. There are some core capabilities to the AI Design Assistant that are available now. There are more that are planned for a future release, but right now, there are two related to images. So there is an Unsplash library now that's baked into Blackboard where you can search for images to include in your course. The AI Design Assistant can generate some keywords, makes it a little bit easier to find images without having to decide what to search for yourself, although you could also put in your own search terms. But the AI Design Assistant will also create images for you, completely constructed from scratch, not something that exists, not something that's stock imagery, but something created based on the content of your course to accompany it. You can also ask the AI Design Assistant to propose test questions for you based on the content that you've put into a document in your Ultra course, or just based on the broader context of your course. It can generate a variety of types of test questions, which again, you can then review and decide whether you want to use or not use, and which you can modify and customize even after you've decided that you do want to use it. It can also create prompts for other types of assessments. Right now, it will offer authentic assessment prompts, things that are more focused on real-world application or creation synthesis, think higher levels of the Bloom's taxonomy, for assignments, for journals, or for discussion boards. You can determine which level of Bloom's taxonomy you'd like the prompt to be at, and the Design Assistant will give you some options. Again, things that you can customize after the fact. And these, what amuses me about those, is they're also specifically designed to discourage students from using AI to create them. So they'll create prompts, things like create an infographic, something that is harder or impossible for an AI tool to create on behalf of students. So you can use AI to try to create assignments that your students can't use AI to answer, I guess. AI to counter AI, yes, thank you, Summer, exactly. You can also then have it generate a rubric. So if you have an assignment prompt already, you can ask AI to generate a rubric to assess that assignment prompt. And the final one is if you're starting from an empty course, if you have maybe your learning objectives, you can have the AI Design Assistant generate potential modules for your course. And by modules, I really just mean the structure, the topics. It'll create a topic, a description, and an image, and put those into a learning module for each of those. Again, all of these, once they've been created, are fully up to you to determine whether or not you would want to accept and add to your course or not. It's also then completely editable by you after the fact. So if you get it and you like it, but you want to tweak something, you can edit, customize that, delete it. The idea here is to sort of supercharge your design efforts, help you take your course from where it is to a step ahead by adding in some additional assessment tools, for example, or by helping you get started, particularly if you're teaching something that's a new course prep for you. Some of the future capabilities include things like being able to specify specific content. So if you wanted to have a test bank that's based on a specific piece of content in your course, you can define that as the context to get even more specialized results. These tools are currently only available via a pilot, because we do want to ensure that this is a tool that fits our needs and that serves a purpose for us before we enable it and make it available just to everyone. So if you would like to be a part of the pilot, this QR code or URL will again take you to sign up for the pilot. We've had about 50 or so people, I think, sign up from the fall semester already, and we can continue to add folks all through the spring semester, so it's never too late to sign up. We'll be collecting feedback from the pilot to see whether the results were useful to you, whether you found this to be harmful or disruptive in some way, in order to inform further decision-making about whether this is something that becomes generally available. It is open to anyone at the campus. So for staff potentially who aren't teaching, we're happy to help you get set up with a space where you could test it out yourself in a course in Blackboard. And it's primarily intended for faculty of all ranks and classifications, but we've also had some graduate teaching assistants who are interested. We do ask for faculty permission from whoever is supervising them before we just give a GA access to use this in a course. So we do have some safeguards in there too. The one thing that the Blackboard is not pursuing in terms of AI is, and I want to be clear, is checking whether students have used AI in submitting their work. There are a number of reasons for that, but the primary one is that the AI detection tools are just simply not accurate, and there is far too much risk of causing harm to students by identifying work as having been generated by AI that wasn't, as well as there's a lot of bias inherent in those checkers that tend to identify students from our minoritized populations as being more likely to have used AI inappropriately. And so to avoid that harm, Blackboard has taken kind of a stance that is not something that they're pursuing at this time because the tools just don't simply back that up. I assumed that was probably going to be a question that was going to come up, so I thought I would address that here. But I'm also willing to take, for as much time as we have, a few more questions.
Hi, I'm Courtney Hughes from Public Health, and I have a quick question. So there's tools like this for the instructor. Do you know, as Anthology, do they have any tools that they're developing using AI for the students? So something that might help maybe organize themselves for the course or something like that.
Right now there aren't, but they wanted to start with where they felt, quite frankly, was probably the lowest risk, and offering support tools for faculty seemed fairly low risk to them because this was something that you could then use in a well-informed fashion. And so something like offering tools to students is something they're interested in, but they want to be really cautious about doing that. And I think that'll be longer term down the road. If anyone has specific ideas like that for what you think would be supportive for students, I'd love to hear them and pass them along.
Hi, Taylor Atkins, History. I was wondering, you know, one of the problems with ChatGPT, although it's to our benefit as instructors, is that it's not good at citing sources or anything, and it only knows material up to 2020 or something like that, and can't always apply specific things. Is one of the benefits of this particular kind that it can suggest reading materials that we might miss otherwise? Because I would think that that would be one of the better applications for it.
That is not one of the current capabilities, but that is a great suggestion that I'll pass on. Right now, the design assistant is trying to stop short of generating or suggesting content. It's really taking your content and helping to transform that into assessments and other things.
Okay.
So that you retain that access and control. But yeah, That's a great suggestion.
Well, I don't know if we could have one without the other. If it cites sources for us, it will for students. So, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
A question I know I shared beforehand, but who owns the intellectual property of those assessments or that content?
That is a fascinating question that has, I think, much bigger implications too than just this design assistant. So the AI design assistant, once you have reviewed the content and accepted it, it's indistinguishable from something you created natively. So as far as who owns it, the institution certainly doesn't own it. Blackboard doesn't own it. The question is, I think, ultimately whether you own it, and I see our College of Law in the background too. I know there's lots of fascinating things going on right now in the legal realm related to intellectual property and artificial intelligence. The most recent ruling that I'm familiar with said that if it's generated by AI, no one owns it because no one created it. I'm interested to see how that continues to play out in the courts. I think for now, it's safe enough to assume that no one is going to claim that they own it other than you, if that helps. Whether or not you could then make a claim that you own it would be up for the courts to decide, I think, at this point. But certainly in terms of broader intellectual property, the university does not own it, Blackboard does not own it. And once you've accepted it, particularly once you've revised it, I would say, then that becomes your intellectual property in ways that it isn't anyone else's, at least.
Hi, Shane Sharp, sociology. I'm ethically troubled by this, and I wonder what it means for academic integrity that we are, that faculty use AI to basically come up with course content. A lot of us faculty in here would punish students grade-wise, whatever, if we found them using AI to turn in their assignments. But you're asking us, or at least to pilot, something which we're doing, and it seems sort of hypocritical. So I just wanted to respond to that. Thank you.
Absolutely. Another great question, and I think one that we're continuing to grapple with, really within academia and outside of academia, is when is it appropriate to use AI for our work and when isn't it? With this particular tool, we're trying to explore the potential for it more than advocating for it or suggesting that you should use it. It's more about making it available so that we can explore those spaces and determine what really is appropriate or not. And the same is happening for us with our students, of course. In some spaces, it is appropriate for students to use it. In others, it might not be. And I think as we continue to wrestle with that, we'll see a lot of change in the way that we think about our use of it, our students' use of it, or more broadly, the place of AI and generative AI in particular in our lives. But no, I agree. There's certainly some tension there between saying that it's okay for us to use but not students, but we and our roles are also very different from our students and their place in knowledge creation or knowledge gaining as they're learning versus our role as the faculty in front of the classroom. So I don't know that it's specifically in conflict so much as there's a debate to be had that informs our practice.
Stephanie, I mean this a serious question. It may sound humorous, but given some of the implications of what you said, do you want us to pilot in a program that might ultimately replace us?
I fully understand it being, you know, a serious question that also at the same time sounds humorous. And the intention from Blackboard and Anthology is to put tools in the hands of faculty as the critical point in the process. The AI, and particularly if you pilot it and you try it, it is not going to replace you. The tools that are here, certainly right now, are not going to replace you. They are not at even close to that level. But that obviously does beg the question further down as the tools evolve, what happens? And I think that's up to us as an institution, us as academia, to navigate that direction. We saw just recently a lot of conflict in the world of entertainment with the Screenwriters Guild and the Screen Actors Guild related to the role of AI in their fields. And I think that this is part of just the beginning of that debate and where we go. I also think, though, if we're not exploring the tools, if we aren't piloting and trying them out, that can't inform our decision making and our policies further down the road either. Thank you.
I think that's not seeing anybody else standing up. If there are, please do feel free. But I think that's a great segue into. Oh, and we do. I'm sorry. We have our student rep, Chris English.
Chris English, SGA. I know this might be a bit far for a pilot program kind of question, but what if repeatedly we have students saying that the questions that are given to them appear to be AI based and not necessarily good? Like, I don't know that this would necessarily happen, but I could see it where a professor or a GA routinely uses AI generated ones and they're not as best suited for learning. and you hear that response, what do we do with that professor or GA or whatever?
So again, this is where the tool specifically puts the human in control. So if the questions in the course appear to be of low quality or and are coming from the AI, ultimately that responsibility is on the individual who accepted them and put them in the course. And so I think that follows some of the same procedures that we have and the same practices we would follow if students were finding exam questions in general that were low quality or ill-suited or struggling with a faculty member's policies or procedures. I don't think this tool changes that really, because the tool itself isn't creating the materials, that the tool is offering suggestions that the faculty ultimately choose. And that's the purpose of having that human in control. I don't know if there's anything else that somebody wants to add from a different perspective, but that's my perspective at least on that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And I think, thank you, Stephanie, for coming and sharing. And I just want to convey to faculty senators here that we're engaged in a conversation, myself with Stephanie and Jason Rohde, about this conversation more broadly beyond just the tools in Blackboard. So if there's anybody in this room, that's interested in being involved in those conversations, that would like to be not just learning about the tools and learning about how to use them in your courses, but shaping policy, shaping our guidance and our philosophy of use of AI on campus, both for faculty, for students, for staff, in all the different ways, please don't hesitate to reach out to myself, to me, to Stephanie or Jason, as we bring that together. And this is one of those things we heard from the surveys, that we want to understand best practice, better practice, good guidance and policy for our students, for our faculty, for our campus as we engage in this, because it is, you know, it has that disruptive technology moment, and we want to make sure we're being thoughtful, piloting things, thinking things through, and being informed, not just by Blackboard's perspective, but by faculty's perspective, by our campus's perspective. So thank you again for coming, Stephanie. All right, that brings us to item 9, which is new business. You'll see item A is the Bob Lane Award, call for nominations. You can look at page 7 in the packet. The Bob Lane Faculty Award recognizes an NIU faculty member for special service to the faculty. If you could, written letters of nomination should be submitted to me no later than noon Wednesday, February 14th. And there's a list of the past recipients on page 7 as well. That brings us to B, the proposed amendment to Faculty Senate bylaws, which is on page 8. And this is related to Article 4.8.1.6, University Assessment Panel, the administration representation. And this is a first reading. And I think Amy Burrow was going to join us for that, but I'm not sure I saw her.
I don't see her either. Can you just introduce
her? Yeah, I'll be happy to introduce it in her stead. So this proposal is to add a non-voting representative of the Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning to the University Assessment Panel membership. The University Assessment Panel reviews and offers consultative feedback on assessment plans and mid-cycle status reports. This work enables members to see patterns indicating lack of assessment-related knowledge and skill, patterns that could be addressed through campus-wide Center for Innovative Teaching and Learning programming. By incorporating a CITL representative within the University Assessment Panel, we anticipate improved communication and understanding of assessment-related professional development needs. And more timely interventions, as well as more proactive approach to optimizing assessment practice on campus. In addition, the proposal includes a grammatical or clerical update to the article in question, part B, which removes the term ex officio. If there are any questions or other information related to this, please feel free to voice them. I think that was just standing up to walk. All right. So that then brings us, hearing no discussion on that topic, that brings us to item C, which is the proposed amendment to Faculty Senate bylaws, which you'll see encapsulated or in pages 9 through 30. And that is changes to Article 3, the Standing Committees of the Faculty Senate, Article 8, the academic personnel process. Article 9, the general academic personnel procedures. This is the first reading that I'll give some context on before discussion. So I've put together a few slides. It kind of mirrors what's on page 9, the comment box, but gives a little bit more context for this. So I wanted to make sure that we went over the goals as well as the process for the that went behind the process that this comprehensive proposal went through to get to this stage. So the goals of the work, we have these three that are on the screen that we want, that there was an effort across all of the different moving pieces here that wanted to move our tenure promotion system to be more equitable, to be one that works for all of our faculty members and recognizes the various contributions of faculty on campus. The second one was this idea of local control being an important facet to tenure and promotion. We wanted to make sure that that was central to all these efforts. And an overarching alignment of the tenure promotion system with university goals, mission, vision, and values. One of the goals that is not up on the screen is that was our principle that was guiding this work was that whatever was developed across the efforts was reflective of NIU and applicable to NIU. It wasn't just something taken off the shelf and placed here, but I think that these goals plus that additional principle is evident through the approach taken to these various parts of the work. So the first set of changes or proposals that came through was folded into this package, came out of the Faculty Senate Social Justice Committee's work. They've worked on this over the past 2 years. There was an engagement with literature, best and better practice from other universities. There was an effort to develop proposals, and then those proposals were taken across campus in various ways to make sure they were vetted and informed by college councils, by faculty members, by senior administration, and also not listed here, but the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee as well. And then in this past December, the Faculty Senate Social Justice Committee voted on a package of changes to Article 8, and those have been forwarded on to the Faculty Senate President. Another effort that was key to the package of changes you see included in front of you is that of the Clinical and Research Faculty Working Group. This came out of it was identified that there was no guidelines for promotion for our clinical or research faculty in our Faculty Senate bylaws. And this was a sin of omission, and it was something that ought to be corrected. And so this working group was convened with Interim Dean Bill Pitney as the chair last academic year. They put forward recommendations, and part of those recommendations were a set of proposed changes to the Faculty Senate bylaws. In Article 3, 8, and 9. This was then taken up by the Faculty Senate Personnel Committee this past fall and was voted upon and passed and forwarded on to the Faculty Senate. The third source of proposed changes came through ongoing conversations through various shared leadership spaces, as well as shared governance conversations and in alignment with university goals. But fundamentally was focused on work and conversations that were trying to systematically and at an institutional level provide support and infrastructure for transdisciplinary, interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary work, as well as community engaged work. And these recommendations have come from conversations with shared leadership groups, from faculty experts, through conversations with senior administration and others on campus. These three sets of changes came together, it became this comprehensive proposal in front of you today. The proposal under consideration brought them together. It's brought together this way and not seen as separate items for efficiency, as there was overlap between these three different proposals where the same paragraph or article was going to be changed multiple times. And so in order to align those and make it a one-time proposal, that effort was decided to be done together. But I think the more compelling reason is that they all started from a similar point of view, which is the goal of this inclusive, aligned, and equitable changes to our tenure and promotion system, that they all work towards towards those three items that were listed in the comment box there in an effort to modernize our tenure and promotion system. It was to ensure alignment with the mission, vision, and values and university goals between our tenure and promotion system and those, and then to make sure there was an equitable and inclusive system that sees as valid, valued, and valuable the broad range of high-quality work our faculty members engage in. With that, I'll open it up to comments, questions, and thoughts on the proposal that is that we're having the first reading on.
University of Chemistry. I see that the changes, many of the changes are not that significant and mostly improve what already is here, but I am surprised that the item 834, time and rank for promotion, was completely removed without any replacement, which pretty much means that if it goes forward, then a person may request promotion, let's say to associate professor in 1 year, and next year promotion to full professor. Is this the reason for that, or is there any reason for that, or was it just omission?
Thank you for the question. I'll do my best to respond to it. And if other folks have perspective on the conversation that went behind it, please do feel free to share. So this is something that has been flagged by others as well as a point of question. So I've been doing a little homework to figure out where this change came from. I was on sabbatical last year, so was not present during this change. But what I understand for it is a that the situation that you're suggesting is unlikely to happen, where year after year somebody's able to go up. But I think the idea of it is that the tenure and promotion bylaws and guidelines and policies at the local level, at the department, or the college level would likely never allow a faculty member to go up in that kind of sequential order. And this is seen as a barrier, an unnecessary barrier that says if somebody meets all the criteria locally after their fourth year, what is it that requires them to sit for another 2 years in that position and just wait if they've already met the requirements of the local decision-making processes and policies, besides just time and seat? And that was seen as a less than compelling reason for it. And then the inclusion of the word extraordinary enters in this idea that there's various interpretations of what extraordinary is and how do you define extraordinary. While colleges and departments can define it in a concrete way, it's a point of tension that can occur of how does extraordinary get operationalized. So that was the rationale for it being removed. That's the gist of it, that it would still be local policy would still be able to set the barriers or to set the requirements for tenure in alignment with their field to earn that. And the timeline component being less important than the quality of the candidate as they put themselves up for promotion.
Yeah, I think I see this point and I think I agree with that. But the problem is the local units bylaws have to conform to this bylaw, because that's what really defines basically pretty much all the local units bylaws will have to be modified in order to kind of reflect this major bylaw. Faculty Senate. So, and since this Faculty Senate by law does not include any time and rank option, basically the requirement, that would mean that the local units would have to remove it as well in order to match to what the Faculty Senate by law says. How that would be considered then?
Yeah. So I'm not sure if the removal of this would would mandate departments would have to remove any. Like, again, you can always be more strict than these bylaws. That's my understanding, but I would want to firm that up and vet that I'm correct on that. That's just my perspective. But I think one of the things that I've been thinking about, like, is this piece has come up here. It also came up at the steering committee meeting as a flag of a question. And it seems like a relatively large change that maybe we could think through a process of putting this back in for now with the expectation that we would have an informed conversation about how to deal with time and rank as a potential solution and saying, if there was a sufficient concern around this and the rest of the changes, there's not, removing this change and focusing on it in a working groups type manner.
But I think this is a good, that would be a good way forward. Yes, I think if not, so that this crossed out paragraph would be removed, basically would be brought back the way it was, so that the document we're going to vote this time would actually include this paragraph, because otherwise it would be indeed a huge change, which pretty much comes out of nowhere. Of course, it was discussed at the committees, but like for faculty senate members, most of them have not seen this. It has not been discussed at any units or anywhere. So I think this is a major change, and I think it should be retained for now. And probably another committee and longer discussion, much more, I think, serious discussion has to be done in order to decide whether it has to be removed.
I appreciate the thoughts, and I welcome other perspectives on 8.3.4 or other items as they pertain to this.
Hi, Mark Falkoff, Law. I just wanted to understand a little bit how this works. Sorry, I had it on my iPhone. The criteria for arriving at personnel decisions, so I think I was looking at 8.2.7, which talks about effectiveness in teaching or librarianship, and then there are some changes to teaching. So we have command of subject matter, skill in presenting materials, and so forth. And then if you jump down to what's currently, for example, K, so K, I believe, is added the co-development and co-delivery of courses outside of faculty's home academic units and or discipline. L, collaboration with other faculty members from different disciplines to improve the academic offerings and experiences of students. I guess my question is just, those seem more the goals to promote. Is not sure where this fits in as with respect to, are these requirements moving forward in order to demonstrate effective teaching? In other words, must we become necessarily interdisciplinarians, even though we may want that, but is that now a requirement? I guess that's all I'm asking.
Just for folks following along at home, that's pages 15 and 16 on the teaching part. The answer is no. There's nothing in here that says you must become an interdisciplinary teacher or scholar. It's simply saying these are the way it's intended to read, and if it doesn't read that way, we can look at the language, is that these are criteria. 8.2.1.7 are criteria that personnel decisions could be appropriately based on, can include these. And so if there's strong, like clearer language, the intention is to say, if somebody does this co-development or development across disciplines, traditional disciplines, and does interdisciplinary work, that is a valid and valued type of teaching or profession or community engaged teaching. Those are spaces that are now named as valid and valued, but it doesn't require anybody to do anything. But these are just ways that people can demonstrate effective teaching.
That's what I suspected. I think maybe the language could be a little clearer, but I'd have to look at it carefully. But I think right now it's a little ambiguous, but maybe.
If it's a little vague, I'm happy to revisit that to make sure that would be clearer and tighter to convey exactly what it's supposed to convey, because it's not supposed to say you must be a transdisciplinary teacher now. It's meant to say if you are, great. If you're interested in it, great, because it will be valid. So thank you.
Teresa Rado, Law, as well, had to follow Mark. I just wanted to go back to the time and rank and say that conversation came up within our college as well on why this was removed, and it was expressed that it would be better if it were put back in for now and language needed to be tweaked. But I just wanted to add to that unprompted came up in our conversation as well.
Great, thank you for sharing. So what I'm hearing around 8.3.4 is that there is a desire for that to be placed back in, unstruck through, with the intention that that would be something that would be taken back up in a more intentional manner to make sure it aligns with the will of the faculty, to make sure that that policy is well thought out. Are there any other comments or questions or points of clarification related to the first reading? Brendan?
Yeah, this is let me see. It's on page 17 at the bottom. It's point 5 under C. Let's see, that is, so that's 8.
Can you please,
thank 8.2, you. Brendan Swethell, Political Science, 8.2.1.7, the C point 5 under that. So it's basically at the top, bottom of page 17, where it says that annual merit valuations. Okay. I think that solves it. I thought it was saying something about considering service workloads when evaluating other areas of annual review process. Okay, I just misread this. I thought this was like the tenure review, but it's merit, annual merit.
Thank you. All right. So again, this will come, we'll make those adjustments in the clarification of the language around what is seen as ways to determine evidence of high quality teaching, and then the consideration to put back in 8.3.4 and have a further directed conversation on those, on that item specifically, so that we make sure that it gets the vetting that it, the appropriate vetting that it deserves. All right, that takes us on to our next agenda item, which is 10, which is reports from councils, boards, and standing committees. We have no report from the FAC to the IBHE this month. Next up is the University Advisory Committee to the Board of Trustees. We do have a very brief report here that I'll give. Please feel free to add if you'd like, for those who are there. The main thing that I wanted to share is that at that Board of Trustees meeting in December, President Freeman shared the university goals, the updated university goals for 2024, and the board had questions on those, but accepted them, and they were approved as the university goals for the upcoming year. I welcome folks to join or to look at the minutes and reports that were on that are posted on the website for any other information, but that's the main new piece of information that came out of that meeting to share. All right, that brings us to item C, the Baccalaureate Council, which I believe we have no report for. Faculty Rights and Responsibilities Committee and Social Justice Committee, neither one of those have reports, they have not met since the last time we've met. The Faculty Senate, there's no report either from the Faculty Senate UC Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee. Student Government Association, I believe we have a report from Chris English. Wherever you'd like.
All right. With election season, both the national, state, local level, as well as our universities for student government is ramping up. We are starting to get ready for that. So be on the lookout and start telling your students to possibly consider running and to be aware of elections. We have also sent out a form to a lot of the student organizations to prep for annual funding. So if you are a faculty advisor for a student organization, please reach out to your officers and to make sure that they have filled out that form, so that way the process for annual funding can go much easier. Also, there are still plenty of seats open on Senate for the current session for the student Senate. So if you have students that you think would be good fits or just students in general, please direct them to my way or to SGA as a whole. And same thing for student justices for our Supreme Court, our student Supreme Court. We're also still looking for student justices for those. So if you have students that you think would fit well for those, please send them our way.
Landon Larkin, student body treasurer. Just one thing we're working on the executive side is coming up with SGA Connect events. And those are going to be aimed toward developing further relationships between student government and students as we serve as their liaison. So please reach out if you have any ideas with how SGA can better connect with the students. Thank you.
Thank you both for the report. Next up is our operating staff council. I believe there's a report and no report, and then supportive professional staff council, and there's no report. Great, which brings us to our informational items. A through O are the standard ones. You can find minutes and the policy library there. Item P is our upcoming Faculty Senate schedule. Our next meeting will be held on February 21st in this room at 3 p.m., which brings us to adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn the meeting? Valentiner first. Do we have a second? Arado second. All in favor? All right. Thank you all.